it bad luck.
Okay, hi, YouTube, TikTok, we got people here on TikTok, we got 69 people on TikTok, nice, it went up to 73 right when I said that, but for a second there, it was 69. We're live on YouTube as well. Welcome back to the show, from a Blanket Fort recording studio, in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. It's People Pleaser again, and it's just me again. I think for the next few weeks, it's just me. I don't know. I don't have a lot of guests scheduled. I just got back into doing the show, so like it's just me for now. We'll get back into doing guests and stuff, but I do miss this format of just being able to sort of talk and not have to like write out a script. I've been doing these long form YouTube videos where I'm sort of doing like video essays and I have to write out a script and I have to edit the whole thing. And it's sort of nice sometimes to just be like, I'm going to write out notes and then I'm just going to talk. So that's kind of nice. And for some of this stuff, I think I like talking to you guys. I like talking to people in the comments and everything. Patrick Hudson just said, Austin, love the album. Thank you so much. I hope you got it. I hope you got a vinyl. We got a lot of people who've been buying the vinyl lately. The double vinyl is available. It's the holiday season. If you're looking for a good gift to get someone or to get yourself, you can get my double vinyl. Beautiful Things, the deluxe edition, now available in a beautiful limited edition double vinyl, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, links in all of my bios on all of my things. You can get that, and it's beautiful. It's a really, they did a wonderful job. It's a really legit, beautiful gatefold thing. The vinyl is gorgeous. It's the, you know, one side is pink, the other side is blue. It's got blue and pink paint splatter on it. It's lovely. It's a double vinyl, asked somebody on TikTok. Yes, it's a double vinyl. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. Check it out. Links in all of my bios. Great. Flynn Scott just asked on YouTube, hey, Austin, excited to be here. If it's not too much trouble, any advice for someone wanting to start a YouTube channel? And my advice would be what I give everyone, which is just start. Just stop thinking about it and just do it. You're going to be bad at it for a little bit, most likely. You might get lucky and just be amazing at it right away, but usually it takes a while. It's a learning curve. And I was making content for years and years and years before I had an audience. And then I only had an audience for a couple of years before the algorithm decided that I shouldn't have an audience anymore. And here I still am, still doing it. So you just do it. Okay, we have a lot to talk about, so let's get into this. I don't want to do it, but I decided I was going to talk about this, and I should talk about this maybe more than I already have. I made like an hour and a half long YouTube video about this. Then I made two videos for TikTok referencing the YouTube video and talking a little bit more about it. But the problem with talking about this right now is I genuinely have not... I've not had a harder time talking about any other thing in the 4 years that I've been doing this full time. I talk about a lot of things in the socio-political space, a lot of things in the space of just what's going on in the world and my thoughts on them. And a lot of people naturally, because of the sort of audience that I've cultivated and the vibe that I've cultivated on my page, feel like they're, I think, are surprised that I haven't been talking more, making more content about what's going on with Israel and Palestine and what's going on in Gaza. I took my time to try to make that first video and try to write a script that I felt like could adequately express how I was feeling. And even that didn't wind up going the way I wanted it to. It was very, the comment section was just an absolute nightmare. I did everything I could to try to state my positions as clearly as possible, and that didn't stop people from thinking that I was saying the opposite of what I was saying. I would say something like, I am unequivocally and without exception against genocide. And then people in the comments would be like, so you think genocide is fine? And I would be like, yeah, I don't know how I can say it in a less ambiguous way. I don't know how to more clearly say something than I am unequivocally and without exception against this thing. And then people would be like, so you're an apologist for genocide then? And I'd be like, yeah, I guess I don't know how else to, I can't say it any clear. I don't. And then some people were like, well, maybe it's just the way that you're communicating. Maybe the way that you're communicating isn't getting through to people. Have you ever thought about that? And I was like, sure. But I really do think that I am, I think I'm saying it as clearly as I possibly can say it. I think I'm saying it in no uncertain terms, so I'm not sure. And that's what I want to talk about today is something that I think might be contributing to our breakdown in communication right now in the online space. I really feel like our online discourse is floundering. We are having a very hard time hearing each other and seeing each other. What's particularly concerning about this topic to me is the way that it has really fucked up and divided the left. It is rare that an issue drives a wedge between people in my personal friend group and in my personal audience like this has. Usually, the people that I'm trying to get through to and communicate with are people who are ideologically opposed to me anyway. I'm trying to communicate with, you know, ideological conservatives and Christians and people who, you know, in general, we don't share a lot of the same beliefs. We don't share a lot of the same philosophies. We don't share a lot of the same perspectives and opinions on most things. And I'm trying to find a way to communicate with them. And I feel like I have a unique way into communicating with them because I was raised conservative and Christian. And I have lived a life where I had a lot of those viewpoints, and I came around to a lot of different viewpoints. So I feel like I have a way of communicating with those people, of breaking down the arguments for the left and for what I believe is a more progressive way of viewing things that can get through to people like that. But when it is the left, when it is my audience, when it is my friends who are at each other's throats and at my throat and just ready to with so much vitriol and just hating each other and throwing each other under the bus and throwing each other away, and just you hear one wrong thing that a person says who you like, someone that you're friends with, someone that you've – whether it's just a person that you're friends with online or a person that you're friends with in real life, someone that you followed for years, they say one wrong thing about this that hits your ear the wrong way and you're like, fuck that person. We're done forever. And That's really tough for me because I'm going like, okay, what's happening here that we're not hearing each other? And then when I do try to step out into the online space and say something, even when I try to really craft my language to say something really, really, really clearly, people are hearing the opposite of what I said. That video that I made on YouTube, I just had a conversation with a person where they made like a 5-point list of things they had a problem with, and every single one of the things they were saying, I just was like, well, my response to you is that's not what I said. So like they were like, here's 5 things that I disagree with that you just said. And all 5 of the things I was like, I can't really even have a debate with you because the 5 things that you're mad about, and they were written out like in a paragraph each, like 5 paragraphs of points that they were, I was just like, well, my response to you is that's not what I said. Like, I just didn't say those things. And the person insisted that I was saying those things. And I was like, then you have to show me the quote of me saying those things, because I can give you the timestamp and the quote of me saying the opposite of those things, because that's what I said. But you can't give me the timestamp and the quote of me saying the thing you're saying I'm saying, because I simply did not say it. So like this person said, you know, I made an analogy in that video, in the YouTube video that I did, where I said, you know, I support Black Lives Matter. I support the cause for racial justice in America. I support the historical validity for that cause, that like just the weighing the historical nature of America's racism and white supremacy and institutionally enforced racism against communities of color. The Black Lives Matter movement is still incredibly relevant in the 21st century, and America's problem with white supremacy and institutional racism is still a very modern problem, and I support that cause and that fight. And I was sort of making this comparison to say, you know, historically, the cause for Palestinian liberation and Palestinian freedom has a lot of historical merit and validity, and weighing the historical injustices that Israel has committed against Palestinian people and all this stuff, I can support that. And then I was trying to go like, I said, Now, let's say that Black Lives Matter organized itself into guerrilla factions that were carrying out coordinated acts of violence in the name of this cause of racial justice. I still might go like, yeah, sometimes you got to get violent for racial justice. But let's say that one of those coordinated attacks of violence killed my family members, like killed, like, you know, my mom and my dad and like my brother, you know. And I said that would make the issue emotionally complex for me. And what I really said is, I don't know how I would feel. That's a hypothetical that I really can't fully understand emotionally without experiencing it firsthand. And that is the experience that people are having in that region firsthand. There are people who are even like, they're Israelis who are sympathetic to the Palestinian plight and situation and the Palestinian viewpoint. There are like many Israeli journalists who are willing to call out the IDF and call out the war crimes of the Israeli government and all of this thing. There are like, but then you have to think like, these are people who this conflict has defined their entire life. This has been a part of their lived experience from birth. And these are people who like have real blood in the game, and it can make it emotionally complex. And also things like, you know, just being indoctrinated with heavy propaganda from the day that you're born can make it really emotionally and intellectually complex. But I said that like something like that in that hypothetical would make that emotionally complex for me. And this person was like, so you, when you said that you wouldn't support Black Lives Matter anymore if they killed your family, I disagreed with you. And I was like, well, first of all, that's not what I said. I didn't say that I wouldn't support the cause for racial justice anymore if Black Lives Matter killed my family. But also like, there were a lot of people in the comments who also agreed with this person, and they were like, yeah, if Black Lives Matter killed my family, I'd still be about racial justice. And I was like, well, yeah, for sure, of course. But also, that's kind of wild to be like, I'd be totally cool with my family getting killed and act like in that – first of all, for a lot of these people in the comments, it's a hypothetical. And second of all, they're acting like they know how they would respond in that – hypothetical, in that extremely volatile hypothetical. That and all I said was basically like, I don't know how I would respond. And all I was trying to do was find some humanity in the situation, trying to humanize people that you might be upset at or mad at, and trying to say like, here's the very real non-hypothetical emotional experience that people are having. Can you try to put yourself in that situation and imagine how that might shape your worldview? And people were like, absolutely not. Fuck you, Austin, for even suggesting such a thing. And yeah, this thing, the reason why it's so difficult for me to approach is because I just am like, we're just not hearing each other. And I don't feel like when I step out, I'm being heard properly. I don't feel like, and I even doing this podcast right now, I'm just like so certain that it doesn't matter how clearly I try to state my positions, I won't be heard properly. And there will be people in the comments of the YouTube video of this podcast and of the anywhere that you can make comments on this podcast, there will be people insisting that I'm saying something I'm not saying. And that's something that I think I just have to sort of accept as a starter, as a starting place, is like people are going to misinterpret and misunderstand my words. So let me start off here. Just like I did in my YouTube video, my YouTube essay I made about this that's an hour and a half long, let me start off here once again with a very, very clear, unambiguous statement of my personal position in this. First of all, my position is that no one should give a shit what my position is. Who cares? I'm a, you know, white guy from Salt Lake City, Utah, who has largely just been activated to talk about this in the last couple months like most people in America have, even though this has been going on for my entire life. So take my opinion and position with a grain of salt. But my position is that I am pro-Palestine. I want an end to the suffering of Palestinian people. I would like a world where Israel receives legitimate pressure from the international community to end its occupation and genocidal ethnic cleansing campaign, you know, in Gaza against Palestinian people. I would like to see freedom and dignity restored to Palestinian people. I want an end to their suffering. I've got a lot of people in my comments anytime I post a video right now saying, how come you can't just say you know, free Palestine or that genocide is bad. And I'm like, well, I have said those things. I will continue to say those things. They're not going to be in every single video that I post. But again, this is like I see a lot of people just sort of assuming the worst right now on the internet. People in my audience, people who I am ideologically aligned with. I see people who like we are on the same team, but because I'm not using the exact right language that they want me to use or with the frequency that they want me to use it, I might as well just be the enemy. But yeah, I'm going to state that if you're listening to this episode and you're feeling prickly and you're feeling squirrely, I'm going to encourage you to hang in there and to keep in mind that that is what I have stated is my position at the top, okay? That like, I'm probably on your team. We probably agree, okay? The problem that a lot of people in my audience have had is that I'm trying to find the humanity across the board. I'm not trying to play both sides or be a centrist. I'm being very clear that I'm aware that historically Israel has inflicted more harm on Palestinian people than Palestinian people have on Israel, that I'm aware of the historical imbalance and the historical asymmetry of the situation, that I'm aware of the lopsided nature of the power dynamic, and that I'm not saying this is just a situation where both sides are just as bad as each other and have done just as much harm. Want to be really, really clear about that. That being said, I am trying to find, in a lot of the ways that I communicate, I'm trying to find the humanity across the board because I have friends who have their identities very closely wrapped up in this, and I'm trying to not dehumanize them or discount their emotional reality in this situation. All that being said, I went to the Comedy Store the other night. I'm going to go back. I want to say one thing. It's been said to me in AA meetings, and this has been something that I try to remember in my day-to-day life, but it's not always easy to remember. And I think that this is something that's going on in our online discourse right now. It's been said to me, I'm not responsible for my first thought, but I can be more responsible, or I am responsible for my second thought. And, you know, sometimes my actual reality is I can't really help my first, second, and third, and fourth thought, but I can, if I'm determined to, change my fifth, maybe my sixth thought. And what that means essentially is like, I have an ego that steps in and reacts, often defensively, before I can even really make a decision of how I want to react to something. So it's sort of like being in my car and getting cut off on the freeway. And defensively, the part of me that doesn't want to die in a car accident right there, defensively, instinctively reacts and says, "Motherfucker, how dare that person do that? You piece of shit." And that happens before I can even really make a choice of how I want to respond. My first thought reaction just comes in, guns blazing. And it can be really hard to move around that first thought or even that first, second, and third thought and move into a space of, hey, I don't know what's going on in that person's life who just cut me off. Maybe, you know, they're having a medical emergency and they're rushing to the hospital. Or maybe they just didn't see me. Maybe it's just as simple as like, I was just kind of in their blind spot. And maybe they noticed me as soon as they got over and they thought to themselves like, oh my God, I can't believe I cut that person off. And it was just like a totally innocent mistake. Who knows? But like, in order to get past that first thought, I have to be intentional about it. I have to want to rise above it. I have to want to move around my instinctive, defensive anger response and into something that's a little more empathetic, something that's a little more humanistic, something that's a little more where I'm sort of trying to find the humanity and find the commonality in the situation. Okay, so that being said, the name of this title, by the way, or the name of this post, the name of this episode, by the way, is getting past the first thought. So that's why I need to say that at the top here too. Getting past our first thought, okay? So I'm at the Comedy Store the other night watching a comedy show. And Marc Maron and Nick Kroll were there, amongst other people, but they were like the big names on the ticket. Okay. These are two people that I'm a fan of. These are two people I was excited to see live. I've been listening to the WTF podcast for years and years and years. I was listening to Marc Maron back before I got sober, and I even sent him a drunken email one night, you know, saying like, "Marc, thank you for talking about being sober. You talking so openly about this helps me. It inspires me." Like, I have a very emotional connection to Marc Maron. I don't always agree with everything Marc Maron says on his podcast or just says in general. But I like Marc Maron, and I think that if we were to ever meet each other in real life, we would get along. I think we would have more in common than not. Like, we have a lot of things ideologically, politically in common. And, you know, I don't know about Nick Kroll. I just think Nick Kroll's funny. Like, you know, and I like him as a comedian and as an actor and as a character actor. And, you know, I respect these two people who are doing well in the industry that I'm in. But yeah, Marc went first and then Nick went, but both of them, and I'm not going to really talk about their material because this isn't material that they've released in like specials. And this is done at a comedy club where like, you know, people don't, you're not allowed to have your phones in there because like this is, it's sort of a safe space for comedians to go in and work out new material and work stuff out. I will say, I've never seen Maron this rough around the edges and upset, and that was kind of nice because that's sort of what he's known for. He talks about this a lot on his podcast, that like he gets like mad at the audience sometimes and like people piss him off and like he'll just like do stuff just because people in the audience are making him mad. And he talks about like his resentment that he has for the audience sometimes, and I got to see that version of Maron on stage, and that I there was something kind of like nice about that, to be like, ooh, this is mad Marc. Like, I'm getting to watch Marc be kind of mad at the audience. There was a table back in the corner of people who wouldn't shut the fuck up, and I was annoyed at them. They kept talking, and I was like, why do people always do this at comedy shows? Why can't they just shut up? And none of the comics before Marc had called them out. I kept waiting for someone to be like, what the fuck is going on back here? Who? What are you guys talking about? And finally, Maron did it. And I liked that he didn't even make it a bit. He didn't even like make it a joke. He just was like, hey, what are you guys doing over there? He was like, can you guys shut the fuck up? It's a comedy show. Can you try to not make this about yourselves for a few minutes? He's like, what are you doing, shots or something? You guys having a party? He was like, cool, shut up. I'm going to do my job. And I was like, I love that. I love that it wasn't even like, I'm going to turn this into a crowd work bit. He was just like, fuck you, shut up. I thought that was fun. But another thing that has Marc feeling a little down in the dumps or squirrely or angry right now, and he talked about this, he said, you know, boy, it's a tough time to be a Jewish person right now. It's a really tough time. He said it's never really a good time to be a Jewish person, but boy, it's really tough to be a Jew right now. And he mentions something about like nothing brings the world together. Like the whole world's divided on everything, but nothing brings the world together like anti-Semitism. And Nick Kroll said something to the same effect. Nick Kroll came out and said something like, boy, it's not a fun time to be a Jewish person. And I gotta say, my first response was, that's disappointing. That's a disappointing take. My first response was like, come on, guys, have a little perspective. My first response was, if I were a comic going on after them, I would be like, yeah, anti-Semitism always exists, and it's never like an particularly easy time to be a Jewish person in the world. But you know who it's a little harder to be in the world right now? A Palestinian person living in Gaza. Little harder for them. Just a little harder for them. Like, I felt like that take was, and I don't necessarily like this expression. I've heard this expression called ableist and stuff. It was a little tone deaf. And I use that in a way, it just seemed like a bad reading of the situation, that like what's going on right now is everyone's just sort of united that we don't like Jewish people right now, that like everyone's united under the banner of anti-Semitism, and it has nothing to do with just people being loudly, vocally critical of the IDF and the Israeli government because they're carrying out an active genocide in front of the entire world. That, to me, rubbed me the wrong way, and I had that response of, that's disappointing. And that's one of my least favorite comments that I get from people, is people who hear me say something, people who have been following me for years, who have watched hundreds of my videos, who have nodded their heads in agreement with my take on so many different things, who hear me say one thing that rubs them the wrong way, and they jump into the comments with that first reaction and go, this is disappointing. I'm disappointed by this. You've disappointed me, Austin. It's one of my least favorite comments I get, because it just reeks of like entitlement. Like I owe, like these people feel owed that I should never say anything that they even slightly disagree with. That it's just, I should never disappoint them. Like you've I was a supporter of you. I was a fan. And now you've said something that disappoints me. It just, there's something about it that's so like elitist and arrogant. Like just like, oh, disappointment. Oh, I really thought you were a smart person who always had the right opinion about everything, which is my opinion. You always have the same opinion I have, which is the correct opinion. And today you really disappointed me by, it's condescending, said someone on TikTok. Frida said it's condescending. And that's what I did. My gut reaction, my initial reaction to hearing these people who I've been aware of for years, who I've agreed with on so many different things, express that right now they're feeling a little unsafe and a little bummed out to be seeing and experiencing so much anti-Semitism. My first reaction was, it's a little disappointing that you can't see past yourself and you can't see that what's really happening is people are just coming to the defense of the defenseless, that people are coming to the defense of Palestinian people who have been the victims of Israeli aggression for decades now and who are experiencing one of the worst periods of Israeli violence in the history of this conflict. Like this is like one of the last few months is like one of the most ramped up worst periods of Israeli aggression throughout the entire history of the long history of the conflict. And that you can't see that that's what's happening, and it's not just the world uniting under the banner of anti-Semitism. So I will admit, that was my first reaction. And if I ran with that first reaction, I can run with, I can create all kinds of conclusions. I can just go to all kinds of places and go, you know what this means? This means that Marc Maron values Israeli and Jewish life more than he values Palestinian life. He values and cares about Israeli and Jewish pain more than he values and cares about Palestinian pain. He doesn't have any sympathy for Palestine. Marc Maron doesn't care about what's happening in Gaza. Marc Maron doesn't care about Palestinians or the Palestinian plight. And I can run with all kinds. I can create all kinds of really, really unfavorable assumptions about who Marc Maron is and how he views the world based off of him just sort of pointing out that he feels like he's experiencing a heightened amount of anti-Semitism right now. And I can do the same thing to Nick Kroll. Or I can experience my first thought, my first defensive, instinctive response. I can hold that and then move past it and ask myself some questions. I can ask myself, did Marc Maron say that he values Israeli life and Israeli safety and Israeli, you know, pain more than he values Palestinian life and safety and pain? Did he say that? Did he get on stage and say, I just got to say personally, I just care about Israeli people more than I care about Palestinian people. I just care about Jewish people more than I care about any other kind of... Did he say that? And no, he didn't say that. I can try to infer that if I want. I can infer that, but like, if I want to be intellectually honest and favorable and charitable, and if I want to try to find the humanity in the situation, I can really ask myself, did he actually say that, though? No. Did he say that he doesn't have any sympathy for what's going on, or that he doesn't find any valid criticism to be made of the IDF or the Israeli government? Did he get up there and say, I actually think that everything the Israeli government is doing is totally cool, and I think that they should be going harder, and I totally support it all? No, he didn't say that. And neither did Nick Kroll. They didn't say that. What they did is they expressed, as Jewish people, very simply, the fact that they feel a little unsafe right now. That they feel a little uncomfortable. You know? And that's it. They just sort of said, my personal experience right now, as a member of this globally marginalized and oppressed group, is that I feel a little unsafe. Now, the reason why a lot of people who are pro-Palestine, a lot of pro-Palestine leftists have a problem with this is that we want to be able to make that clear delineation that being critical of the Israeli government, being critical of the IDF, and calling out the war crimes of the Israeli government and the IDF is not the same thing as being anti-Semitic. We really, really want to make that clear delineation, and we don't like when people are seeming to conflate those two things. And again, that's another question that I can ask myself. Did Marc Maron stand on the stage and say, when you criticize Israel and the IDF, you're being anti-Semitic? That's the same thing as being anti-Semitic. Did he get on stage and say that? No, he did not. Did Nick Kroll get on stage and say that? No, they did not. But that's sort of where we go with it, is like, hey, no, that's, and I, to be honest, that was another thing that I felt, as I was like, when he said nothing unites the world like anti-Semitism, I was kind of like, I don't know, man. I don't think that, first of all, I don't think it's true that we're all agreeing right now and that we're all united. I think that in many ways, I don't know if I've ever seen us more divided and more unsure of like where we're supposed to stand on a particular issue or how we're supposed to communicate about an issue, especially just within the progressive left. I've never seen such heated division on a topic. So I disagree with the assertion that everyone is united under anti-Semitism. And I definitely know that a lot of my friends who are pro-Palestine are not doing that in an anti-Semitic way, that they are just simply looking at the power imbalance that exists in the situation and siding with the side with less power, with less institutional power, and which is very just prototypical of the left. That is typically just how the left operates, is in any situation where, you know, two sides are pushing against each other, usually the left will side with whatever group has less institutional power in the situation. And they're looking at the war crimes and the genocidal behavior and rhetoric coming from Israeli leaders and the Israeli government and many people in the IDF and many supporters of the IDF and saying, we cannot just stand by while genocide happens. And that has nothing to do with a deep-seated prejudice or hatred toward Jewish people. But so then I start asking myself, okay, so I think that Marc Maron and maybe even Nick Kroll and a lot of my Jewish friends who I see saying similar things, who I see talking a lot about anti-Semitism right now online, because I have a lot of like close personal Jewish friends who are also like, boy, a lot of anti-Semitism going around right now. And my instinctive defensive response is like, that's not what's happening. Which, you know, I'm making that delineation. I'm making that distinction between criticism of the Israeli government and the IDF and anti-Semitism. And I don't feel like that person's making that distinction. So I can make that unfavorable first response, first thought characterization of that person and go like, how do you not get that there's a distinction being made? Or I can get curious and start asking myself the question, where is that coming from? Where is this idea that our criticism of Israel and the Israeli government, the IDF, and our support of Palestine is equal to anti-Semitism? Where does that come from? Why are so many people saying this? What is that stemming from? And if I ask myself that question and I want to get honest about the behavior of my fellow leftists who are very pro-Palestine, there's some spaces that I can actually look at and go, I can see how someone could get anti-Semitism from that. First of all, just on a sort of, in a sort of general sense, I will say, and I wonder if people can get on board with this, that like, it feels kind of weird to me for non-Jewish people to be telling Jewish people what is and is not anti-Semitic. It's sort of our standard position as racial justice activists and as people who fight for marginalized communities to allow marginalized communities and historically oppressed communities to define what does and does not constitute bigotry against their community. Typically, it's not a great look if a cisgender person is explaining to a trans person what does and does not constitute transphobia. It's not a great look if a white person is explaining to a black person what does and does not constitute racism against black people. You know, it's not a great look if a man is explaining to a woman what does and does not constitute misogyny. But right now, in our online discourse, we have a lot of non-Jewish people Gentile-splaining anti-Semitism to Jewish people. And somebody just said Zionism isn't a good look. Yeah, this is what I mean about, like, people just forget so quickly that, like, we're on the same... Maybe you just showed up, but, like, yeah, we're on the same page with that. Like, you don't need to convince me of that. I've already stated my positions very, very clearly in here, but, like, you see that, like... And this is another thing that's happening is... Even just hinting that you're going to try and find some humanity and trying to find some humanity and what the other side of the debate or the argument is saying, people, there are a lot of like pro-Palestine people on the left who view even just the idea of approaching trying to find humanity in what your Jewish friends are saying as like, that's both siderisms, that's playing both sides, that's centrism, you might as well just be a genocide apologist. And that nature of sort of like hard line drawn in the sand, clear cut, it's them versus us, it's good guys and bad guys, and there is no room for any kind of emotional complexity or nuance, that I do think is contributing also to the feeling of that people are just like, oh, I think you just don't like Jewish people because you're like not willing to try to open this up to any kind of emotional nuance. But so there's that thing too. So I started off there of you know, it doesn't feel great in general trying to tell your Jewish friends what is and is not anti-Semitic. Now, I personally agree that opposing genocide, the genocide of Palestinian people, is not the same thing as being anti-Semitic. I personally agree with that. And if I see a person, if I were to say, hey, this genocide needs to stop and Israel needs to discontinue its practice of doing war crimes, and someone said, stop being anti-Semitic, to those specific words, I would probably go, I don't think I am being anti-Semitic. I think that you're misinterpreting what I'm saying. I don't think that is anti-Semitic. But I also will say, like, there's a lot of that going around. There's a lot of Jewish people saying, boy, there's a lot of anti-Semitism happening, and a lot of people going, no, there's not. You're conflating criticism for the Israeli government with anti-Semitism, and maybe we're being too quick to say, no, there's not, and shut that down. Because anti-Semitism is very real, okay? Like, Jewish people globally are an oppressed and marginalized people. This is real. They're not making that up. It just so happens that Israel is the only place in the world where they hold real institutional power and weight. So in this particular situation, it is Israel, which is a predominantly Jewish nation, that holds the institutional power. But globally, Jewish people are the victims and have been historically the victims of oppression, marginalization, and, you know, usually we define these things based on power dynamics, right? The reason why we say that you can't be racist to a white person, especially in, like, a country like America where white people hold a lot of systemic and institutional power is you can be prejudiced against white people, but you cannot wield institutional power against them because the institutions and the systems are designed to favor them. And so power dynamics are what define whether or not you can actually, you know, be institutionally prejudiced against a certain group of people. That being said, it's like that makes it kind of hard. It's like, can you be anti-Semitic to Israel, which is a very powerful, wealthy nation that has a lot of institutional weight and institutional ability to carry out its prejudices? Well, that's a tough question because Israel is made up predominantly of Jewish people who globally don't have a lot of institutional power or representation. So you can, they can experience institutional prejudice and bigotry in most places in the world. And they do. But this is like, I mean, so anti-Semitism exists, and right now, a lot of like white supremacist anti-Semitists are taking the opportunity of Israel's bad behavior to come out and say a lot of full-throated anti-Semitic things. And so a lot of Jewish people online are actually experiencing an influx in very real anti-Jewish bigotry and anti-Jewish hate. And for people who are used to experiencing that kind of prejudice, to be experiencing an influx of it creates a feeling of being unsafe. And then for everyone that they're usually allied with, people on the left, people who are usually coming to their defense to say, that's not true, that's not what you're experiencing, that's not real, that only heightens the feeling of like, oh, we're losing support. No one believes us. People are telling us that the hate we're experiencing, that the bigotry that we're experiencing isn't real. Heightens the experience of feeling like, wow, no one's on our team. And thus you get people coming out on stage like Marc Maron saying, boy, everyone, I guess the one thing that unites everyone is anti-Semitism. And what he means when he says that is like, well, the right and conservatives have always been anti-Semitic. That's nothing new. But now people who typically politically align with me are also sort of saying things and doing things that make me feel unsafe as a Jewish person. And that feels like unanimity, like everyone's unanimously agreeing on this. And so I'm trying to find the humanity here. Another thing that I think could be contributing to this is like, you know, in my hour and a half long video essay that I made on this topic, I said again several times in that video, I stated that I have a decidedly pro-Palestine position in all of this, that I acknowledge several times the historical asymmetry of the situation, the historical, you know, lopsided nature of it. I acknowledge just the death toll, that like just the death toll from one side is drastically larger than it is for the other side. I acknowledged all of these things, and I still said that I view innocent victims as innocent victims, and that I refuse to feel sympathy for innocent victims in any sort of ranked or prioritized manner, that I am not going to prioritize the amount of sympathy or empathy I extend to innocent victims, whether they're Israeli or Palestinian, that when innocent people die, That's innocent people dying, and I am not going to decide how much or little I care based on their identity. So essentially saying that I care as much about the 1,400 people killed on October 7th as I do about the 20,000 people who have been killed since. And that sentiment right there for a lot of pro-Palestine leftists was a no-go. That was like absolutely not. Essentially kind of like the idea is like, I guess, because of Israel's historical wrongdoings and bad behavior, those 1,400 people are an acceptable cost, and they more or less, I guess, had it coming. And I gotta say that sentiment right there, like not allowing people to extend equal sympathy for innocent victims, even people who are saying, hey, I want Palestinian freedom and I want an end to the occupation. I want an end to Israel's genocidal ethnic cleansing of Palestinian people. I want to see that over. I want the international community to put pressure on them to stop that. Saying all of that and then saying, but I also have equal, I feel equal pain and sympathy and empathy for all innocent victims, regardless of where they live, what, you know, where they geographically are located, what their identity is, what their nationality is, what their race is. And for people to say, no, 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 that's no good. If you say that you're a centrist, you're a both sideser. I can see how pretty quickly for Jewish people trying to parse all of this out, for Jewish leftists trying to parse all this out, that could look a lot like hatred for Jewish people instead of just criticism of the Israeli government and the IDF. That saying, I'm okay with those 1,400 people dying because 20,000 is a larger number than 1,400, and I'm going to prioritize which victims I care about more, that could look like, oh, so you believe that my identity can die and should die in this conflict. In fact, I've seen a lot of people who that's just straight up in their comments. I have Jewish friends who like are getting DMs from people who are going, you know, 1,400 wasn't anywhere near enough. I wish they had been able to kill a lot more. I wish that Israel could be wiped off the face of the earth. And you can see pretty quickly how that can start to feel like there is no delineation being made between being anti-IDF or critical of the IDF, critical of the Israeli government, and anti-Jewish. That pretty quickly it's like, oh, you're just lumping us all together into one big thing. And that's a thing too, is over and over and over again, I see pro-Palestine people on the left saying, well, we're making a distinction. We're not going to get convoluted here and mix up criticism of the Israeli government with anti-Semitism. We are making a distinction between those two things. We are not going to hold the Israeli people accountable for the actions of the Israeli government. And then at the same time saying, if you show sympathy for the people who died on October 7th, then you can't sit with us. Those two ideas are not the same. Those two ideas can't really coexist and make coherent sense. They don't really work together. And you can see pretty quickly how it does look like, if that's your stance, that any sympathy being shown for the 1,400 people killed on October 7th means that you're essentially not on Palestine's team, and that you can't sit with the pro-Palestine crew, that could look pretty quickly like you do want the Israeli people to be held accountable for the actions of the Israeli government, and you are not interested in making a distinction between the Israeli people and the Israeli government. And you could also see how Jewish people looking at that in the discourse could go, oh, so like, yeah, I agree with you that the Israeli government is behaving atrociously, but like, you just want all of us dead. And that could feel and look a lot like just straight up anti-Semitism. So I'm saying all of this going, my initial reaction was the same as yours. My general position is largely the same as yours, but I'm trying to find the humanity here so that we can hear each other better, so that we can communicate with each other better. You know? I don't know. The comments are blowing up, as one would presume. I've got about 15 more minutes that I can be here, and then I gotta leave. I'm going to go to the comments here. Nathaniel St. Clair says, all you are doing is complaining about leftists. Yeah, that's because that's who I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the division that exists in the left right now. That's welcome to the conversation. That is what we're talking about. I'm talking about the fact that this issue has divided the left. We always knew the position of, you know, people on the right. Like we always take it for granted that conservatives are racist and, you know, don't care about brown people as much as they care about white people and are largely anti-Semitic. That's sort of something we always have known. But among the left, typically, before this was injected into our online discourse, Jewish people are largely on the left. So we have, I'm unaware of a division, says, I mean, I just can't, I mean, then you're just not paying attention at all. I mean, are you participating in this conversation that's happening right now? Are you seeing, Are you seeing the comment section on this conversation occurring right now that you're participating in? I was unaware that anyone disagreed about Israel and Palestine. I'm unaware that there's any division when it comes to how the fuck? Can you imagine saying that right now? Can you imagine existing in the world right now on the internet and someone says, I'm trying to address the division that exists when it comes to the discourse we're having about Israel and Palestine, and then someone goes, I was unaware that any division existed. Jesus Christ. Id Roberts on YouTube says, you get people like Elon who are promoting anti-Semitism and then being like, but I do support Israel, the worst kind of person. And that is what's happening on the right, you know, is like that kind of full-throated anti-Semitism that you're used to seeing. But I think that where it gets convoluted in the left is that people go, hey, I'm not anti-Semitic. I never have been anti-Semitic. I've never supported anti-Semitism. But I refuse to feel bad about the people who were killed on October 7th. You know, a way to look at it is it's like 9/11 was a tragedy, you know, about 3,000 people just going to work that day. You know, getting on planes, traveling, going about their lives, and they were all killed in a blazing inferno, and it's a tragedy. That being said, from a diplomatic and from an international diplomacy standpoint and an international policy standpoint, the United States had been poking that bear for decades. The United States had been like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? And bullying that region and you know, and kind of goading on an attack like that for decades. And the United States, as an entity, as a global entity, sort of had it coming. That doesn't mean that those people in those buildings or those people on those airplanes woke up and had it coming that day. And now you can look at the United States response to something like that, to a tragedy like that, that then you just go into several countries, many, you know, Iraq that wasn't even involved. I mean, a country didn't even do it. It was a guerrilla faction of, religious extremists. A country didn't even do it, but you just go in and start carpet bombing cities and killing people indiscriminately and killing innocent people and killing millions of people over a 20-year campaign. And it's a massively disproportionate response. And there's nothing conscionable about the weight of the response. It doesn't change the fact that those people who died on September 11th still didn't deserve to die. And so all I'm saying when I'm saying, can you extend sympathy to the 1,400 people killed on October 7th is like, can you at least just say the behavior of the Israeli government does not justify those deaths? Those deaths are still tragic. The same way that you might be able to go, the behavior of the American government still does not justify the deaths of the people who died on 9/11. Kihafa Spiller says everyone already does on TikTok. And I'm saying, no, they don't. I'm telling you that me offering that perspective and saying that has been, people have jumped down my throat for saying that. People on the left, pro-Palestine people on the left, have been very, very upset at me for extending sympathy to the people who died on October 7th, have said, you know, yeah. And then you say over and over and over again. Yes, some people do. I do that, but a lot of people don't. And I'm saying that's where the problem is coming in. That's where the feeling of, where are they, asked Nathaniel St. Clair. Just go and look at my comments on my YouTube video essay. Go, like, and again, when you say, where are they? Like, again, you're just being willfully ignorant of the situation that's going on in our online discourse right now. You're pretending like it doesn't exist. You're pretending like I'm just making this up. Like everything I've said, no one's ever had a problem with it, and everyone's actually been really, really happy with me. Now, that's another thing that when your Jewish friends say, hey, I'm experiencing a lot of anti-Semitism right now, and you go like, no, you're not, that dismissal of their experience is not going to make them go, you know what, good point. You know what, you're right, I'm not. I'm being dramatic. And that's the same thing for me when I say, hey, I expressed sympathy for victims equally across, I said in my video that was decidedly very pro-Palestine, by the way, my video where I stated several times that I'm against genocide and that I want the genocide to stop and that I'm pro-Palestine, I said I refuse to extend sympathy for victims in any way that prioritizes or ranks their pain, and people were furious at me for saying that. And I tell you that that is a real thing that happened, and then you say, no, it's not. Do you understand how unreasonable you're being? Do you understand how absurd that is to have a person go, hey, somebody DM'd me the other day and told me that they want all Jews eradicated from the earth. And you go, oh yeah, is that person in the room with us right now? Did that really happen? Or where are they? I don't see them. And you say something like that. Do you understand that's a really fucked up and unreasonable thing to say? Kahifa Spiller says, I have a different experience. Exactly. Exactly. And do you understand that your experience is not the experience, is not the monolithic experience of everyone on the internet right now and everyone participating in this discourse? Do you understand that your myopic, your little teeny tiny, like, this is like, I get comments, I'll post a video that's just like a comedic video of me just like, you know, just making a joke, and someone will be like, would it kill you to say that you're against genocide? Could you just make a video and say that genocide is bad? And I'm like, I have. Those videos exist. Like, you could go in, but because this is a person who is scrolling through their feed, and the only video that they see from me that day, and maybe it's the only video they've seen from me in weeks, is me making a joke about something and not me saying genocide is bad. And so they just assume I've never said genocide is bad, and that I also don't think genocide is bad, that I actually am like pro-genocide. And it's like, but I've actually said very specifically that I'm not pro-genocide, but because you're getting a very, very, very small portion of the words that I've said in the last few months publicly, you're assuming that I haven't said it at all. And that's what this person is doing. You're getting a very, very, very small sliver of the online discourse, of the totality of everything that every person involved in this online discourse has said to each other. And in your sliver of the experience, you're not experiencing what I'm talking about, so therefore it doesn't exist. Just like a person saying, well, I haven't seen the video of Austin saying genocide is bad, therefore that video does not exist. If I have not personally seen it, then it doesn't exist, and Austin is pro-genocide. So, like, you're in here in these comments being a perfect example of exactly what I'm talking about. You're running with your first response, with your first thought. You're coming into a conversation halfway through and hearing a few things that you disagree with and you don't sit right with, and jumping to a ton of really unfavorable and uncharitable assumptions about who I am and what my beliefs are, and painting with this, just going, oh, I know exactly what this guy thinks, and he's lying, he's making things up, he's pretending that people have said things to him that they haven't said. And that is what is happening. That is what the breakdown in our discourses right now. And you're also denying that there is a breakdown in our ability to communicate with each other. You're pretending like it doesn't exist while you're actively contributing to it. So, and I think that that's, again, that's what your Jewish friends are experiencing, is they're experiencing you contributing to their feeling of not being safe and to their feeling of anti-Semitism while telling them that it's not happening. Haley D says, you can't assume that you know what everyone is experiencing though, right? Are you asking me that question, Haley? Because that's my point. That's what I'm saying, is that you can't assume that you know what everyone is experiencing. That if you're having one experience, that doesn't mean that that is the experience. That means that that is your experience. And when someone else is saying, this is what I've been experiencing, you should default to trusting them. So like when someone says they don't know, you can't really say they do know and are being bad faith, right? I mean, I can trust that these people have been involved in the online discourse and have not seen anyone disagreeing. I have a hard time with that, but I'll go ahead and offer them the same grace that I'm asking them to offer me. I will believe that they are involved in online spaces where no one is disagreeing about this topic, or having any kind of difficulty communicating clearly, even though that doesn't, that's not my experience. That is not, the experience than I've been having. Yeah, and then Magila Shuwal said, yep, just do all the war crimes you want, BB. I sure hope you're not directing that comment at me, because that's just nowhere near anything that I've even come close to saying at the at any point in this live stream or podcast episode. If you're if you are directing that at me, Magila Shuwali, if you are directing that at me, you are being the perfect example of everything that I've been talking about in this episode, which is like, I've just stated over and over and over again in this episode that I am decidedly pro-Palestine, that I want the genocide and the war crimes happening to Palestinian people to end, that I want the international community to put sufficient pressure on Israel to make it end, to make it stop. I've said that. This is probably the fifth or sixth time that I've said it. And you're coming in just going, yeah, I guess Austin just thinks that Bibi should get away with whatever he wants and be able to do war crimes. And it's like, yeah, so somehow, some way, there is something happening that makes you incapable of hearing the actual words that I'm saying and makes you assume that I'm saying the opposite of what I'm saying. And that's been my experience. And my anecdote about seeing Mark and Nick at the comedy store was that I didn't want to do to them what I've been experiencing. They said something that gave me a knee-jerk response, that gave me a first-thought defensive response of, why are they prioritizing their own fear and pain and not acknowledging that it's a lot harder for a lot of people in the world right now than it is for them? And then I sat with that, I tried to move past my first-thought defensive reaction and go, why is it that so many of my Jewish friends are expressing that they feel like they're experiencing an influx of anti-Semitism right now? Are they all lying and making it up? Or could it be that they are experiencing very real anti-Semitism and also behaviors from pro-Palestine leftists that feel like anti-Semitism, even if that's not the intention? You know, we talk a lot on the left about intent versus impact. So if your intent is not anti-Semitism, but to just criticize the IDF and criticize the Israeli government, but the impact of what you're saying is landing like anti-Semitism to your Jewish friends, maybe try to consider what it is about what you're saying that is making it land like anti-Semitism. And if you are saying things that sound like you're very unsympathetic to Jewish people in the world right now, and that you're very unsympathetic to Jewish pain and Jewish fear and to just sort of Jewish people expressing themselves and expressing their experience, that could sound to a lot of Jewish people like you don't care about them. And if they're hearing stuff that sounds like you don't care about them, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump away from you inherently don't like them. And they are used to, as a globally marginalized and oppressed people, that being rooted in anti-Semitism. So, like, all I'm asking here is I'm trying to find a way for us as leftists who have so many of the same values to be able to communicate with each other more clearly right now. Because I feel like we're all that. I feel like that experience that I had of being disappointed that Marc Maron said it's a hard time to be Jewish in the world right now, and that Nick Kroll said it's a hard time to be Jewish in the world right now, I feel like that's an experience that a lot of pro-Palestine leftists are having when they get on the internet and they see their Jewish friends talking about their experience of being Jewish in all of this and going, why are you putting your pain, your discomfort, your fear first when Palestinian people in Gaza are suffering so greatly? I think that's the experience I had, and I think that's the experience a lot of us are having, and I'm wondering if we could communicate with each other better, find each other's humanity better, if we could move past that first thought response, that knee-jerk response, and go, maybe there is something to the way that we are communicating, the way that we are displaying our advocacy for Palestinian dignity and humanity and rights that isn't landing the way we want it to, that is landing in a slightly prejudiced or anti-Semitic way. anyway, a Amani says, can you give an example of a Jewish person losing their job for being pro-Israeli compared to pro-Palestinian? No, not off the top of my head. And I also don't think that this is useful. I honestly don't think it's useful to go, well, like to play the comparison game, because that's what gets us into this mess in the first place. Is it, and that's why, like, when people go, when, you know, when you express, hey, I, you know, I have sympathy for the 1,400 people that died on October 7th, people go, well, is 1,400 a bigger or smaller number than 20,000? 20,000's bigger, right? So you should care more about Palestinian pain. And I never said that I care more about Israeli pain than Palestinian pain. You assumed that I care more about Israeli pain than Palestinian pain when I just simply extended sympathy to it. So that position shows that you're not willing to even entertain the idea of being sympathetic to Jewish people right now, even though I didn't ever say I'm giving them more preference or more priority. When you play this comparison game of, like, whose pain matters more, so I'm not going to disagree with you here. And I've mentioned several times throughout this podcast the historical asymmetry of the situation. Let me be very, very clear again. There is an asymmetry in power dynamics that exists in this situation that is very real. Israel holds institutionally a massive amount of power, more, just a massively larger amount of power over Palestinian people. That is just institutionally part of this dynamic. It's inescapably a part of the situation. And as a result of that, there is an imbalance in the amount of pain that people from each group are experiencing that I acknowledge and that I agree with. So I am not making the case that it is harder right now to be Jewish than it is to be Palestinian, or that it is harder to be pro-Israeli than it is to be pro-Palestinian. I actually think that I believe very firmly that it is decidedly harder to be Palestinian than it is to be Israeli right now, and it is decidedly more difficult in the professional space to be pro-Palestinian than it is to be pro-Israeli right now. But getting into that comparison and going, well, who's got it worse, is a way to dismiss having to care about what your Jewish friends are trying to communicate with you. And that to them can feel like you're being anti-Semitic. It feels like you don't care about what they're trying to communicate to you. So, I hope that that's clear, that when you instinctively go to, well, you don't have it as bad as this other group has it, you're being dismissive of the experience that they're trying to, of the pain that they're trying to communicate to you, of the feeling of not being safe that they're trying to communicate to you. And that dismissiveness, that sort of condescending derisiveness of their experience feels like you don't care about them. And that's what I'm trying, that's what I'm trying to approach in this conversation. I'm out of time entirely. I'm going to be late for my meeting, and I still have to change my clothes. And there's so many more comments to look at on here. Thank you all for participating in the conversation. Thank you so much for your comments. And thank you for most of you for trying to be reasonable and hear this all out. Someone says you can always do a part two. Yeah, maybe we will. Maybe next week will be an extension of this conversation. But because, you know, just did over an hour again, did an hour and a half on YouTube in a video essay, just did over an hour in a podcast, and I still feel like there's so much more to be said, and that is just sort of indicative of this entire thing and what makes it so complicated. And God, people hate that word, complicated. They hate when you say it's complicated and not simple, and as I said in my video essay, I believe that that is rooted in a feeling of safety. Simple narratives feel more safe than complex narratives do, but if it were complex, then why would it be this hard for us to communicate a simple thing like, hey, can we try to find each other's humanity in this? Can we try to, you know, maybe move past our first, you know, defensive reaction and see how we can hear each other better? Yeah, so there are things that aren't complicated. Genocide being bad, not complicated. War crimes being bad, not complicated. But there are things like trying to parse out the individual emotional experience that each individual person in your life is having with this, and each individual person in your life is having trying to communicate and trying to be heard and trying to be seen in this, or trying to find their spot in this. That's really complicated. And trying to parse out, like, what the most workable solution to all of this would be. That's complicated. Anyway, thank you, everyone. Thank you for participating. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. You know, my double vinyl is for sale. Yeah, it's... I still live in late stage capitalism, and yeah, I still have to pay bills. So you can buy my album by going to the link in the bio at all of my social medias, or you could subscribe to my Patreon, or you could do both. Patreon.com/AustinArcher. Hi, patrons. Love you so much. Thank you for your support this year and all other years and months. And boy, we had a good run this year. Thank you so much for the help. Love you all so much, everyone. Try your best to be patient and kind and to lead with love with each other out there. I really truly believe that the last thing anyone in Gaza needs right now is for us to hate each other. I really genuinely believe that. I think that the world could be better served by us trying our best to be kind and gentle with each other, and to try to find kindness and a gentle touch wherever we can in the world when there's so much violence and so much hatred going around. If we can try to find spaces where we can be kind with each other and can be soft with each other, patient with each other, I do believe that, like, we need to be the balance in the world that we want to see right now. So thank you for being here. Love you so much. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.